You are listening to Expanding Horizons, the podcast of the Unitarian Church of South Australia, a home of progressive spirituality and free religious thought and action since 1854. Views expressed in these podcasts are those of the speaker and are not intended to represent the position of the church itself or of the worldwide Unitarian Universalist movement. For more information, visit unitariansa.org.au.
We light this chalice, symbol of our free faith. May its steady flame be a beacon of welcome to all who seek, a source of courage to conquer fear, and a blaze of hope for the despairing. May it illuminate the path towards wholeness and peace. Welcome. My name's Jenny Dyster. I'm the lay leader of this spiritual community. Love is the spirit of this church, and service its law. Unitarians are neither a chosen people nor a people whose choices are made for them by theological authorities, ancient or otherwise. We are a people who choose to be inclusive and welcome diversity. You are welcome no matter what your faith background or beliefs, your ethnic ancestry, gender or gender preference. You may have your ideas challenged, but not your identity or your authenticity. This is our great covenant, to dwell together in peace, to seek the truth in love and to help one another. After the service, you're welcome to stay for tea, coffee, conversation, and possibly a bit of play. Our first hymn today is from the Green Hymnal, and you'll recognise the tune. It's Beethoven's Ode to Joy, Joyful, Joyful, We Adore Thee. It's time for us to have the quiet time in the service. I have chosen to do a meditation from John Donohue's work. It's Meditation in the Koresh of Thought. Koresh, and this is what John Donohue writes about Koresh. Isn't that a lovely word? It's Scotch and Irish for a type of boat, canvas with a wooden frame. It's new to me, and I love almost nothing more than a new word, especially one that rolls so gently. This love of words sustains and elevates my days, nourishing my heart and soul like nothing else can. They transport my thought like a koresh, moving towards the hearts of others who are willing to meet mine, and in that meeting find the invisible cloak of home. Then follows this prayer or blessing, Banacht. It's a blessing in Gaelic. You may choose to close or lower your eyes. On the day when the weight deadens on your shoulders and you stumble, may the clay dance to balance you. And when your eyes freeze behind the grey window and the ghost of loss gets into you, may a flock of colours, indigo, red, green, azure blue, come to awaken you in a meadow of delight. When the canvas frays in the koresh of thought and a stain of ocean blackens beneath you, may there come across the waters a path of yellow moonlight to bring you safely home. May the nourishment of the earth be yours. May the clarity of light be yours. May the fluency of the ocean be yours. May the protection of the ancestors be yours. And so may a slow wind work these words of love around you, an invisible cloak to mind your life. We will now have 2 minutes of silence. You'll hear a bell, and the interlude will follow. Now think we all our God is not in our green hymnal, nor is a mighty fortress is our God. And these are the top two Lutheran hymns in Germany. Those of us who grew up in the Protestant churches in Australia probably sang either one or both. And I'm going to get Robin to just revive your memories and see if you recall it. It's a great tune, but it brings to mind concepts of God that bother atheists and progressive Christians and Unitarians who often prefer songs that celebrate humanist rather than theist values. And the particular disturbing ideas are that God is the source of all good and we will get our share of the goodies if we're good. And the other idea that's a bit unsettling is God is on the side of our people against all other people. Now, this is nonsense, and nothing could have been further from the mind of Martin Rinkart, who wrote the hymn in 1636, which is precisely 100 years before I thought it was written. I just associated it with Bach. Now, I'm going to tell you the story of Nun Dunkit Alle Gott, not as an argument for introducing it into our 21st century Unitarian services, but because it's a deeply moving story, and it illustrates the role of God in spiritual life. Rinkart was born in Saxony in late 16th century, son of a poor coppersmith. His aptitude for music landed him a job as a chorister, as a little boy, at St. Thomas's Church, which was Bach's church. He attended Latin school at Eilenberg, and he won a scholarship that sent him to the University of Leipzig. He was ordained as a Lutheran pastor, and he became director of choral services at the church at Eisleben. Fantastic start to a career. In 1617, at the age of 31, he became the archdeacon in his native town of Eilenberg, just as the 30 Years' War broke out. The residents of this walled town endured many horrors during this time, and Rinkert stood by his flock while he himself endured the hardship of quartering soldiers in his home and frequent plunderings of his meagre stock of grain and household goods. He was a faithful, caring pastor who attended to the needs of the sick and the hungry during extreme circumstances. Eilenberg became an overcrowded refuge from the country districts where the Swedes had spread devastation and destruction. A steady stream of refugees poured into the city as the Swedish army surrounded it. In 1637, the plague claimed 8,000 people, including most of the town council, exorbitant number of children, clergymen from neighbouring parishes, and Rinkert's wife. He had to do the work of three men, burying 40 to 50 people a day, a total of 4,480. But through it all, he remained well. Finally, it became necessary to bury refugees in trenches without a service. And after the plague, the town was hit by a famine so extreme that 30 or 40 people might be seen fighting in the streets for a dead cat or a crow. Rinkert kept only the barest of rations for his own family, and in time he was forced to mortgage his future income to buy bread and clothes for his own children. As if that weren't enough, the Swedes returned and imposed a ransom of 30,000 thalers on the town. Rinkert left the safety of the city to meet with the Swedish general to plead for mercy. He was refused, and he returned to the town saying, "Come, my children, we can find no hearing, no mercy with men. Let us take refuge with God." He fell to his knees, praying with such earnestness that the Swedish general relented and lowered the demand to 2,000 florins. Through grief and loss, suffering and death, Rinkert always looked to his saviour and could thank God for the blessings he still had. "Now Thank We All Our God" began as a family prayer before meals and later was sung as a national thanksgiving at a celebration service when the 30 Years' War ended. O may this bounteous God through all our life be near us, with ever joyful hearts and blessed peace to cheer us, and keep us in his grace and guide us when perplexed, and free us from all ills in this world and the next. All praise and thanks to God the Father now be given, the Son and him who reigns with them in highest heaven, the one eternal God, whom earth and heaven adore, and thus it was, is now, and shall be evermore. It's a testament to his faith that after such misery, in circumstances described so well by Neil Gaiman in the story For All Ages Today, that he was able to write a hymn of abiding trust and gratitude toward God. He died in 1649 in the place he loved most, Erlenberg. We live in a different reality. The Western scientific revolution has empowered human beings, opened up new worlds and broadened our horizons. And it's made us realize we're not the center of the universe. We cannot understand the world without science. It feels, as it has always felt to humankind, that we stand on a static earth. But our education gets us beyond this illusion. Our planet is moving very fast indeed. We know our ideas don't necessarily correspond to objective reality outside our own heads. We know that some religious ideals are simply the product of repressed sexuality. We know that God does not smite us with plagues, earthquakes, and volcanic action when we're bad. There are scientific explanations for these phenomena, and many of us believe that science is the only reliable means to truth. The problem with going along with this notion is that it can lead to a reductionist view of human nature. Since Huxley, for example, Rinkert and Bach, I should have shown that earlier. There we go, there's Huxley on the left and you might recognise the gentleman on the right. Since Huxley, Darwinians have found altruism problematic, as evolution would necessarily select against benevolence to another at cost to oneself. Altruism can only occur because of the selfishness of a gene. Altruists expect reciprocation from either society or family. Their Byzantine calculations are characterized by lying, pretense, and deceit, including self-deceit, because an actor is more convincing if he believes his performance is real. Even apparently compassionate action is therefore simply a matter of quid pro quo. Do you want to believe that? Feel like that? Rather than feeling that warm glow when we experience kindness, either from giving or receiving. Now, fundamentalist Christians won't have a bar of Darwinian thinking. Today's service I entitled God's Teeth and Bones, first of all because I wanted to talk about God. Secondly, I know God talk can set some people's teeth on edge. And thirdly, I remember when God's Teeth and Bones landed me in strife in a southern suburb school. Now, God's Teeth and Bones is a rip-roaring Elizabethan swear, which I learned watching Glenda Jackson and Keith Michelle playing Elizabeth II and Henry VIII. The wreck of Henry VIII's flagship, the Mary Rose, showed an interesting disparity in the dental health between the crew and the officers. Who had the bad teeth? The officers, exactly. They had access to sugar and the poor people didn't. Now, I happened to use this swear after the paint monitor in my Year 3 class tossed an open bottle of rich yellow acrylic across the classroom at another child. I would have got much less bother with a parental complaint if I'd used the F word. That would have been understood. As it was, I was up for blasphemy. It was a Southern Adelaide school and there were lots of Jehovah's, Pentecostals and assorted brethren enrolled. Needless to say, I never said God's teeth and bones in the classroom ever again. Back to Dawkins, author of The Selfish Gene. What he has to say is worthy of mulling over, but I do think that his disdain for religion and the concept of God can't function outside his narrow straw man definition of religions as social systems whose participants avow belief in supernatural agents whose approval is sought. Dawkins and the other scientific reductionists deliberately avoid the contemplative side of faith. Religion is more than what can be observed by using the methods of anthropology or sociology. Deeply pensive solitudes bring individuals into congregations. Bypassing John Donne, Bach, the Sufi poets and Socrates, Dennett, Dawkins and the rest are free to reduce the religious experience of humanity to a matter of bones and feathers and wishful thinking, a matter of rituals and social bonding and false mythical explanations and the fear of death. Now, as a teen arguing against the existence of God, my dad would wriggle out annoyingly by saying, "Oh, there must be something more." But I've come to believe he was right. The positivist approach would not only marginalise religion, but also arts, culture, history, and the classical and humanist traditions. If we were really completely enthralled to the selfish gene, why not throw all constraint to the winds and just be selfish? Individually, collectively, in politics, in economics? We saw during the 20th century, not to mention the first decade of the 21st, what can happen when a me-first mentality is given free rein. But the 20th century was also the century of Mahatma Gandhi, Martin Luther King, and Nelson Mandela, who revealed the potential for altruism in humanity. The tens of thousands of people who flocked to hear the Dalai Lama seem to recognise that this too is an essential part of human nature. Now, I'm not saying we return to pre-scientific notions of God. We do need to mull over belief and religion. Our tradition comes down firmly on the side of reason. It's the mantra, isn't it? Freedom, reason and tolerance are the unifying values of the Unitarian tradition. Karen Armstrong, author of Case for God, writes about the confusion by Christians between belief and reason, creating bad science and inept religion. She raises the question, should we believe in belief? We call religious people believers, or people of faith, as though acceptance of a set of doctrines was their principal activity. And before undertaking the religious life, many do feel obliged to accept doctrines like virgin births and resurrection that defy common sense. But other traditions prize practice above creedal orthodoxy. Buddhists, Hindus, Confucians, Jews, Muslims would say religion is something you do, and that you cannot understand the truths of a faith unless you are committed to a transformative way of life that takes you beyond the prism of selfishness. All good religious teaching is basically summons to action. Yet instead of being taught to act creatively upon doctrines, many modern Christians feel that it is more important to believe them. Only believe. Why? The Greeks realized two ways of attaining truth, mythos and logos. Both were crucial, but each had its own sphere of competence. Logos was the pragmatic mode of thought that enables you to control the environment and function in the world. But it doesn't enable you to assuage human grief or convince people their lives have meaning. For that, they turned to mythos, an early form of psychology which dealt with the more elusive aspects of human experience. Stories of heroes descending to the underworld were not regarded as primarily factual, but taught people how to negotiate obscure regions of the psyche. In the same way, the purpose of the creation myth was therapeutic. Before the modern period, no sensible person ever thought it gave an accurate account of the origins of life. A cosmology was recited at times of sickness, when people needed a symbolic influx of creative energy that brought something out of nothing. Above all, myth was a program of action. When a mythical narrative was reenacted, it brought light within the practitioner something true about human life, something about how humanity worked, even if its insights, like those of art, can't be proven rationally. If you did not act upon it, it would remain incomprehensible and abstract, a bit like the rules of a board game, which, if you've ever tried to read Hoyle's card game's rules, are convoluted, dull and meaningless until you start to play. Religious truth, then, is a species of practical knowledge. Like swimming, you can't learn it in the abstract. You've got to plunge in the pool and acquire the knack by dedicated practice. Religious doctrines are a product of ritual and ethical observance and make no sense unless they're accompanied by spiritual exercise, yoga, prayer, liturgy, and a consistently compassionate lifestyle. Skilled practice in these disciplines can lead to intimations of the transcendence we call God or Nirvana or Brahman or Tao. Without such dedicated practice, these concepts remain incoherent, incredible, and absurd. Now, during the modern period, scientific logos became so successful that myths were discredited, and scientific rationalism became the only path to truth. Newton and Descartes both claimed that it was possible to prove God's existence. Now, the earlier Christian, Muslim, and Jewish theologians didn't think that. And modern Christians bought into scientific theology and embarked on the doomed venture of turning their faith's myth into logos. The word belief changed in meaning. Before the 17th century, it used to mean love, loyalty, and commitment. By the late 17th century, however, philosophers and scientists had started to use belief to mean intellectual assent to a somewhat dubious proposition. We often think modern means superior, and this is true of science and technology, but our religious thinking is undeveloped. In the past, people understood it was unwise to confuse mythos with logos, but today people read the Bible literally. In creation science, we have bad science and inept religion. In avoiding this religious cul-de-sac, many Unitarians became humanists. We developed our seven principles, which are worthy, certainly, but they leave a gap, emotionally and spiritually. By all means, jettison dubious theology like God must be all-powerful, all-knowing, and all-good. You can't make any sense of the existence of evil or misfortune in the world if you try and keep those three balls in the air. How can you be all good and all knowing and all powerful and let the war in Ukraine happen? It's ridiculous. But don't jettison the hero's journey, the consolation of religion. Don't jettison the idea that we're meant to be good and inspire others to be peaceful and kind. It's only prudent to make a very high estimate of human nature, first of all, in order to contain the worst impulses of human nature, and then to liberate its best impulses. Whether you call that transcendence God or not is up to you. But I think we all yearn for something more than our own well-being. I think we should be cognizant of a sense of the unity of all things. We're not the only sentient beings. Mystics in all the major religious traditions have also imagined what they regard as a sacred energy that infuses the world, a force that goes beyond the modern reductive notion of God. Our ability to eke the increments of well-being out of a pitiless cosmos and to be good to others, despite our flawed nature, depends on grasping impartial principles that transcend our everyday experience. Transcendence is not a flight from critical thinking, but an inescapable part of our humanity. Please remain standing for the benediction. May we leave this place seeking an uncharted and freely chosen way to wholeness, knowing we have companions on the way.
So just before you rush off, I want to give you a 1 month at least invite to two special occasions that will be taking place shortly. So October the 2nd, Sunday, October 2nd, there will be a special morning tea after that service to say thank you and farewell to Jenny. That will be her last service as lay leader. And on October the 23rd, there will be a special luncheon held after the service to welcome our new minister, Chris Hannah, to our church. So I just pop those in your diary so that you know in advance they're special occasions. Oh, and the other one, I guess I should say, the AGM will be held in November the 13th. So there's three dates. Thank you.
Well, we hope you enjoyed this Expanding Horizons podcast. These podcasts are the intellectual property of the presenter. They can be used only with the express permission and appropriate acknowledgement of the presenter and the podcast used in its entirety. This permission can be obtained by emailing unitarianessay@bigpond.com. Please feel free to leave a comment or visit us on Facebook or Twitter by searching Essay Unitarians.